Let's pray and get started. Our Father and God, we thank you for our time together here now. I pray you watch over us and bless it. I pray that you'd give us clear minds as we work through this. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the topic here is the nature of corporate authority. Another, can't hear? Not on? How's that? I think that's one of the laws of teaching. The student has to hear what you're saying. This talk is the nature of corporate authority, boardsmanship, how to function in a Christian school that is governed by a board, and probably more important than that, how to not function in a Christian school that is supposed to be governed by a board. One of the most common afflictions that schools have is brought about by confusion on the nature of boards. There is a drastic problem created by American individualism, which makes everyone think that their own intentions, their own desires, their own opinions are weighted with the authority of whatever group they happen to be associated with. And if they're on a board, this causes severe dislocations in the governance of the school. You don't need to, and as a result, some horrific snarls can occur. And this is one of the problems that we have, is that we tend, when we get into a controversy, we tend to demonize the people on the other side of the controversy. But you really have to understand that sweet Christian people can do awful things, right? And I'm not saying that a sweet Christian person, an individual sweet Christian, can tell lies and commit adultery. And, you know, Jesus taught, by their fruits you will know them, and so forth. If someone is individually being godless, individually being awful, I'm not saying that a sweet Christian person can be a sweet Christian person deep down and be a jerk and a nasty person and vile and treacherous in their actions and still be a sweet Christian person. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is what happens when you have a system, when the problem is systemic, and you have either a Christian school that has been set up in an unwise way, or people don't know how corporate authority works. And you can have someone who is the best next-door neighbor in the world. You would watch, you would let them watch your dog, you let them babysit your kids, take care, you know, look at your house when you're gone on vacation. You let, you know, they're conscientious and honest and decent and, you know, vote the same way you do, and you have a lot in you have a lot in common with them. But if you get crossways with them in some political setup, oftentimes the problem is the corporate disobedience, the lack of wisdom that we have when we set up institutions. All right, so there's such a thing as corporate sin and not just individual sin. Now, of course, corporate structures are created by individuals, and there's always individual sin somewhere. But what happens is individuals get swept up into something that's much larger than they are, and they don't know what to do. And because they don't know what to do, because they don't know how they got where they are, because they don't know how to process it, they behave badly. And they do things that are hurtful and harmful and so forth. So one of the things you want to do is make a distinction, create a sharp distinction in your mind between those fellow Christians that you may have a dispute with over something that is purely individual. All right, there's no other factors involved. There's no other players involved. This is a purely individual difference versus something that happens when someone who wasn't involved in the dispute at all until the day before yesterday, and a problem erupts in the church, and this guy's sister is married to the pastor's son, and the pastor's on the other side of this political divide from you. You know, all right, all of a sudden you've got this big, horrible snarl, and you need not attribute to that other individual all the individual sins and failures of character that you would legitimately do if they just plain ripped you off, right? So if someone comes to you, if your neighbor comes to you and says, hey, can I borrow your car for 10 minutes, and then they disappear with it, right? You don't need to talk about systemic problems or corporate problems. The guy's a thief, right? And you can confront him as, you know, like, hey man, you stole my car, you know. And you don't have to over-engineer it. You don't have to over-analyze it. But what happens is in corporate disputes and big tangled disputes, oftentimes the feelings run as high as they would if he had stolen your car, right? And you start attributing to him or to her all the evil motives of people who did steal your car. And all they did was simply tried to be obedient in the middle of this larger issue. Now, that doesn't mean that it's all okay, that everything is, you know, we're all sweet Christians and it's okay to destroy our school, or it's okay to have a church split, or it's okay to have, you know, it's not okay. We need to address sin wherever it occurs. We need to address individual sin in individual hearts, and we need to address corporate sin at the corporate level. And so this is what this talk is geared to address. So the confusion, the problems, the difficulties need not be attributed to the fact that your opponents on the other side of this dispute are all orcs. Sweet Christian people can do awful things. And oftentimes when you're caught up in this corporate snarl, the awful things that they do are driven by the circumstances that individuals created, and they created those circumstances because they didn't carefully work through these principles, the nature of corporate authority, the nature of decision making in a group. Right. Yep. So, what constitutes board action? What constitutes board action? If you have a, you might have a school that's got a sole proprietor. You know, some schools are a for-profit sort of thing. One guy has the vision. He opens it up. He invests in it. He's the chief cook and bottle washer, and he makes the decisions. Right there, you don't have to address these questions. It's his school. Right, he runs it as a sole proprietor. But almost always, schools are governed by boards. And I think, given the nature of communities, that's a good way to. I think it's a good and healthy way to govern a school. But in order to govern a school effectively and wisely and in a godly way, you have to understand what constitutes board action, what defines board action. So this is a definition of board action. The board should be considered to have acted when something has been moved, seconded, voted on, passed by the appropriate number of votes, entered in the minutes, and the minutes have been approved. When that has happened, the board has acted. And the board has not acted under any other circumstances. Right? The board has one way of acting. Right? And that is to say, look everybody, this is board action. Right? And the way you say this is board action is someone makes a motion, and almost everybody runs on a rudimentary form of Robert's Rules of Order. But let's say you have some weird quirky thing and you need, you know, 2 seconds or something. You invent your own little system. But almost everyone has a rudimentary sense of Robert's Rules of Order. And some of you have a requirement in your bylaws that you will govern your meetings by Robert's Rules of Order. And just an incidental thing about that, a side comment about Robert's Rules. A year or two ago, I had occasion to read Robert's Rules of Order. I got a copy and I read through it. And I was far more impressed than I thought I was going to be. I thought it was just going to be just page after page of gnat strangling and the sort of thing that people who are usually like to be parliamentarians do. But I saw biblical principle after biblical principle being observed, where you have a way of getting the sense of the majority and action while preserving the rights of minorities and dissenting voices. It was really there's a lot of wisdom in Robert's Rules of Order. Most people just know that you move and second and adjourn, and you know, you've just got a handful of things taken from Robert's Rules of Order. But this is one of them that you should take, and it should be defined somewhere in your documents, that what constitutes board action. Your policy manual should have something in it that defines board action this way, and nothing else is board action. If this hasn't happened, if there's not been a motion and a second and then debate and then it's brought to a vote and then it's passed by the appropriate number of votes and then it's entered in the minutes, so you know 3 years from now that that's what you did, right? Here's another side comment. Regeneration does not make your memory perfect. The fact that you're born again does not mean that you will know what you did today 3 years from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. But if the board has said, we will, you know, let's say we will not build the new facility by means of debt. All right, let's say someone's really concerned that you not go into debt, and so they make that motion, it's seconded, it's passed, and everybody says yes, and in the exuberance of the moment, everybody thinks that way. The board acted, and the board acted with regard to the future, right? Sort of downstream. If you didn't write that down, if it's not in the minutes, if you got no way of keeping track of what you did, the board, and then the 5 years later, the board board membership has changed, and there are different people on the board, and you go into debt, you've broken your word. You've done something that you said you weren't going to do. And so if you're going to if you're going to change your mind, then you need to change your mind the same way you made up your mind. You have to go through the same process, and that means you need to write it down. As a pastor, I can't tell you how many snarls I have seen between Christian brothers, business snarls, because they thought that regeneration made the memory perfect, or that regeneration meant that we've defined all our terms, or that regeneration means that we've anticipated every eventuality on a handshake. It's simply false. It's simply not right. Write it down. So, someone makes a motion, it's seconded, it's debated, it's passed by the appropriate margin of votes, it's entered in the minutes, and then the minutes are approved, usually at the next meeting. When that happens, you have board action. Short of that, all you have are guys sitting in a room. That's all you have. There's no such thing as, well, we just chatted about this, and it was sort of the sense and the feeling of the board that we, you know, I got the impression that we wanted to, right? The Apostle Paul says in Corinthians that when the bugle blows indistinctly, when the trumpet blows indistinctly, no one prepares for battle. What is your administrator supposed to do, right? When he's listening to a board discussion and a debate, and what he hears is, no, yes, no, no. And then one board member says, well, I think that that's clear. All right. That means, what that process means is that if a board thinks that way, or if certain key board members think that way, that means you can nail your administrator anytime you want. All right? He's just sitting there. And an administrator ought not to agree to work for a board that functions that way. This is a two-sided thing. If you're considering taking a job at a Christian school as an administrator, this is one of the things you want to make sure they do before you take the job. When we interview on the Logos School Board, when we interview, we go through a number of questions where we interview the teacher candidate or the administrator, which we have not had to do very often. But when we, our interview process is this: we ask all the questions we want to ask, and then the second part of the interview is we ask the candidate, "Do you have any questions for us? Right. Do you have any questions for us?" If you're a wise potential administrator of a school, this should be one of them. How does this board make decisions? What constitutes board action as far as this body is concerned? Right, now, how can this go wrong? If this is not what you're doing, what happens? Now, let me before we get to that, let me touch on something else. What ought boards to do? Okay, what ought boards to do? Boards generally tend to be, in the first couple of years of a school's operation, 2 or 3 years, they tend to be what you might call working boards, as opposed to policy-making boards. The visionaries, the people who wanted the school, the people who are starting the school, frequently they're doing that because they have kids, they want the kids to go to the school, they have a regular job, so the time they're giving to the school is going to be volunteer time, which is going to tend to be board time as opposed to full-time administrator time. So what happens is you'll have a handful of really dedicated visionary individuals who establish the board, and they meet regularly. They meet weekly. In the early years of Logos School, the board met every week. We had a weekly board meeting, and the board meetings were fairly long. And part of the reason is because the board was performing a number of the functions that an administrator ought to be performing. Right, so what's the administrator for? If you find that the board is deciding how often the toilet paper needs to be checked out in the Johns, then you are meeting too frequently. Right? Agendas will expand in order to, this is a variation of Parkinson's law, I think, right? Work expands to fill the time allotted for it. Agendas grow to fill the space allotted for it. So if you have a weekly meeting that's 2 to 3 hours in length, you will find stuff to talk about. Right? And you will find yourself a couple of years into it talking about stuff that you ought not to be talking about. That's too mundane. That's too rinky-dink. Somebody needs to figure that out. There are all sorts of logistical things that go into the management of a school. Someone needs to hire the janitor and tell the janitor what to do and come up with the janitor's job description. And, you know, all of that has to be done. But if the board's doing it and the board is micromanaging, then the board needs to back away from what it's doing. And if they say, well, we can't back away because this will go undone, well, then hire someone to do it. Right? What you're doing is, if you have a board that's micromanaging and functioning that way, you're asking for conflicts. You're asking for collisions. So if the board is meeting that frequently and is deciding the minutiae of the day-to-day life of the school, then the board's meeting too frequently. The board is micromanaging. On the other hand, if the board does not know that the headmaster quit 3 months ago, then the board needs to meet more frequently. They need to have some sort of feedback mechanism where they find things out. One common problem is what I can call the bull elk theory of boardsmanship. The bull elk theory of boardsmanship can be caused by wealth, by personality, by ownership of the building you're meeting in, by sin, or any combination of these things. So you can have... Suppose, for example, that the visionary founder of the school is one of the principal patrons of the school, and without him, the school would not exist. He's given tens of thousands of dollars to the school. He donated the building. His wife is the administrator. And boy, are you stuck. Okay, now, does that mean you shouldn't allow, or should you just say no out of principle to someone who's visionary and generous and bestowing and, you know, all? No, you shouldn't say no. Oftentimes, these are instruments that God will use to jumpstart a school, to get the school going. But if you have a situation like that, what you have to have from the first year on is a plan to get out of that. You need an exit strategy. You need to say, okay, these are troubled times. These are unique times. We've got all sorts of difficulties here. We need a school now. And so we're just going to receive these things that are bestowed upon us, and we're going to be very grateful for them. Right? We're going to be very grateful for them. But we should recognize that as long as we are in this situation, we are an immature school. Right? We are not a mature institution. Charles de Gaulle once said that graveyards are full of indispensable men. Okay? All right, now, this guy's going to go sometime. Right? And what you want to do, one of the principal problems that you have in effective ministries and schools is and monarchies and all, is the problem of succession. How do you hand this off to the next generation? And how do we hand it off to the next generation in such a way that we have faithful men who will understand what we're doing, who get the vision, and who will perpetuate the vision? If you put all your eggs in one basket, I think it was Carnegie who said, put all your eggs in one basket and then watch that basket. All right, be very careful. Well, the problem is, if you do that, you're betting on one state of affairs, and you're not preparing yourself for the inevitable succession. So a successful minister who's been preaching for 30 or 40 years in church needs to be thinking about who's going to be his successor. Can anybody name Charles Spurgeon's successor? Who came after him? If you pick high-profile preachers who have very successful ministries, you say, now, were they thinking about who was going to follow? In the same way with a school, you want to say, are we thinking about the second generation? Are you thinking about not only the school that your kids go to, but the school that your grandkids will go to? So my grandson is now going into second grade. He's 8 years old, right? So the current board and administration will probably be still in place when he graduates from high school, but they'll be just a few years away from retirement. Okay? And my youngest grandchildren, who are a year old, you know, when they're going through school, it's going to be a whole new generation. Well, have we thought about that? Have we anticipated that? Now, this is the problem. People who are visionary, people who are generous, people who are wealthy, and people who are sold on a particular vision, they know their own heart. Now let me divide this in two. Sometimes the bull elk is a godly bull elk, and sometimes the bull elk is an ungodly bull elk. Sometimes he's doing it for reasons of vanity, selfishness, prestige, you know, whatever. Other times he's doing it out of the goodness of his heart, and he wants to help, and he's as generous as it gets. If he's a godly visionary, a godly, you know, he's giving and bestowing and not of trouble, and I'm happy to do this, then he is going to understand why the school believes itself to be immature so long as they are dependent on his particular individual generosity. And he won't resent the fact that the school wants to grow to maturity. All right? 50 years from now, he's not going to be there. Right? And the school needs to be prepared for that time. And what happens is, let me illustrate this from another angle, a child-rearing illustration. Many Christian parents bring their kids up backwards. What they do is when the kid is little, when the kid's two, sin is cute, or comparatively cute. Sometimes it's not so cute, but when a kid holds his breath or flops or, you know, does something and wants something, or it's manageable. It doesn't destroy lives when a two-year-old has a problem. Okay? And so oftentimes parents indulge it. They let it go. They let it go. Or they cater to it. Or our family calls them Walmart kids. You see, All right. I don't have to. That communicated right away, didn't it? You see this kid pitching a fit in the toy aisle at Walmart, and then later on in another part of the store, you see the cart go by with the kid holding the toy that he was pitching a fit over. Well, sin is indulged, sin is indulged, sin is indulged. But then the kid gets older and older and older, and then being indulged, and then they get to be 14 years old, and that happens pretty rapidly, actually. Right? You just turn around a couple times, and all of a sudden you're there. And the kid's 14 or 15, and now the child is capable of getting pregnant, or getting someone pregnant, or getting into drugs, or wrapping a car around a tree. Right? Now they can seriously destroy lives. Sin, all of a sudden, sin has enormous consequences. So what happens there is the parents who've been indulgent up to this point see the kid at 14 or 15 and they panic and go, ah, and curfews and grounded, and they start slapping standards on them because they, you know, you could wreck your life. You could, you know, you could do some bonehead teenage thing and somebody could get killed or some, you know, this is not good. And so you start putting standards on to a child who's not been prepared for the standards. They don't know what discipline is. They've never been taught what discipline is. And all of a sudden you're clamping it on them when they're 15 or 16 years old. How's that going to work? Well, not very well. It needs to be the other way around. When you're bringing your children up, my wife and I believed when our children were 1 and 2 years old that God wanted them to live in a totalitarian police state. Which they did, right? Amen. We have a witness. Right? And my wife knew how to spank and discipline, and she was very good at it. And, you know, she had a little wooden spatula. We joked one time about having a holster made for her. And so the kids, we had very tight, strict standards, very tight. And you've heard Matt Whitling talk on these things before, the tight standards, the high standards need to be combined with love and joy and happiness. So it's a happy totalitarian police state. It's a joyful, the kids don't know any different. But the goal of this is as the kids get older, the parents should be removing standards, right? Taking standards away. So by the time they're 15 or 16, there may be one or two rules left. Because by the time they leave home, there aren't going to be any rules left. If it's not internalized, by the time they're 19 or 18 and go off to college, if it's not internalized by that point, it's not going to be internalized by parental oversight. So the whole goal is to bring the child up in such a way that you're preparing them for the inevitable. Right? They're going to be an adult. I was talking with a friend here, and he said one of the comments he made in child rearing classes is you're not raising children, you're raising adults. Right? You want your child, you want to have in mind where you're going, where this is inevitably going to be. Well, in the same, so this is the principle. You have all sorts of extraordinary constraints and Rube Goldberg operations and ad hoc committees and that sort of thing. Connect in the early years, you're hovering over it in the early years, and you're focused on it in the early years. But the intention from the beginning should be to remove that and to grow up into maturity, so that when the visionary founder goes to be with the Lord, right, when he departs, the school can function without all the extraordinary hovering. So if you just throw a school together and you give it to an administrator who's not trained and it's like an undisciplined toddler, and then you have to come in and save the school later, that's like clamping down on a 15 or 16 year old. So what you want to do is accept and accept gladly all the extraordinary blessings and gifts from the person who is in a position to give them, but recognize equally and have it a commitment on the part of the board and a commitment on the part of the school to grow out of this. All right? We want to grow to the point where we can afford, for example, to pay all our teachers instead of relying on and having our budget grow up around the founding board members' wives volunteer teaching, right? What you have is this bubble in the budget. This artificial problem in the budget. And what that is, it's not sin, it's not evil, it's not wicked. Let the people be generous, right? Let the people be generous. But it's not mature. It's not where you need to be. It's not a grown-up school. And you're not going to get to the grown-up school until you say, you know, we have to grow up. And when you have this grown-up school, and when you have someone who's a visionary who understands these things, he is going to be interested in backing himself out. And he wants to back himself out in such a way that the vision is preserved. And this is another tension or dynamic. If he backs out too quickly, or let's say the visionary really gets classical Christian education, he's really sold on it, he understands it, he's read all the books three times, and he's been to these conferences, and he gets it. And then he hires people who have a sort of scratch and sniff understanding of classical Christian education. And he says, it's not a mature school until I back out, and he backs out too quickly. Well, if he backs out too quickly, then you're just going to have another generic Christian school that doesn't have any distinctive vision. If he doesn't back out at all, then you're going to have a distinctive classical Christian vision until his heart attack. Right? And as soon as he has his heart attack and he goes to be with the Lord, then nobody around here understands why we were doing what we were doing, and nobody gets it. So what you want to do is phase, have this deliberate, premeditated, planned phasing out of generation one and into a faithful generation two. Now, that's when the bull elk guy is godly. If he's ungodly, it's going to be about vanity and personal control and people doing what he tells them to do, and he owns his own company on the other side of town, and everybody there hops as soon as he says anything. And so he assumes the same prerogatives at the school that he founded. And then if a collision happens, he can point to the school I found. This is the school I founded. And the response ought to be, no, it appears to me that this is the school you bought. And there's a difference between founding a school and buying a school. Now, there's nothing wrong, there's nothing sinful about buying a school. If you want to buy a school and put your name on the thing and you pay all the bills and you're the sole proprietor. But if you set up a board, it ought to be a genuine board and not a toy board. It ought not to be a pretend board. It may have to be a board in training in the early years, but you want the board to grow up into maturity, just like you want the curriculum to grow up into maturity. You always want to be thinking about the generation of Joshua and not just the generation of Moses. All right? If this is a relay race, if we're going to pass the baton on to the next generation, how can we do it successfully? You can't ensure that the baton will be transferred successfully between the third and fourth relay, but you can ensure that the baton is passed successfully between the first and the second relay. When you're starting the school and you're saying, okay, I want us to make successfully the transition to where Logos School, to use our example, is a far, today, Logos School is a far superior school to what it was in the early years. There was a lot more excitement and adrenaline and maybe coffee in the first years. I was very grateful for the education my kids received, but one of the things that gratifies me beyond words is I believe that my grandchildren are going to get a far superior education to the education my children received, and I think my children got a good one. Right? I'm very grateful that God enabled us to provide my children with the education they got, but they want something more than that. I want them to stand on our shoulders and then pass it on to their kids. So I'm very excited about the next generation, and that's what we need to be thinking about. And the next generation needs to be a mature school and not a school that's personality driven. And the personality, the visionary, the people, the person who started it, may be godly, may be ungodly. If he's godly, it's still immature. If he's ungodly, it's immature and in spiritual danger. Do you see the difference? All right, so you want to deal with the bull elk theory of boardsmanship. If you have a board, it should be a real board, and that means that the board acts when there's been a motion, second, debate, it's passed by the appropriate number of votes, entered in the minutes, and the minutes are approved. Here's some problems with the board. Here, one, pluralism at the top. This is the problem of thinking where each board member thinks that he is the board. Okay? Now remember, this is, I want to give you some illustrations of how this works. Suppose your board is composed of different types of people, as manifested when it comes time for, say, committee assignments. There are some board members who do not want to be on the finance committee. They don't understand all those green eye shade numbers. They want to be on the curriculum committee. They're a liberal arts guy. That's what, you know, and they're particularly interested in elementary curriculum. That's what they bring to the board is curricular knowledge. They're not a bookkeeper. They don't, you know, so they don't want to be on the finance committee, right? And the person on the curriculum committee has a certain set of interests and gifts, and the person on the finance committee has a certain set of interests and gifts, both of which are necessary for the functioning of the board. Right? The board, because the board has to address both of those sorts of questions. Now let's say the finance guy, the guy gifted in finance, gets a bee in his bonnet one day. I wonder what they're doing in the office about this problem or this problem or this problem. You know? And that board member just goes into the office and asks the bookkeeper, could I have a report of last April and this April? Can you give me these numbers? That board member has absolutely no business doing that. None of his business. He ought to be refused by the bookkeeper. I'm sorry, I can't. Now, if you've got a bookkeeper with that kind of backbone, keep that bookkeeper. Give that boy a raise. Because you do not want one board member with no authority. Now let's say the board has a discussion, okay? The board has, you know, we're not happy with the financial reports that we're getting at the board meetings, and we need to find out what the glitch is, and there's a motion. I move that Harry Schwartz here be authorized to ask the bookkeeper for this information. Second, discussion, it's passed. He has... The board has authorized him to make that request. So when he goes into to talk to the bookkeeper, he is representing the board, right? When he says the board would like, that's a true statement. But if he walks in and acts like the board would like, when all he means is I would like, he has no business doing that. And not only do you want a bookkeeper who will say, I'm sorry, I can't give you that information, but you ought to have an administrator who backs the bookkeeper up or says, I can't give you that sort of information unless there's some sort of board action. The board corporately has authority over every aspect of the school. It does not follow from this, that an individual board member carries the full authority of the board. And let's say everybody on the board is a financial ding-dong except for this one board member. This one board member is the only guy who understands the numbers that the bookkeeper could give him. He still has no right to that information, right? He's just another guy, right? And this is important for all sorts of reasons. Let me give you a more snarled situation. Let's say we are dealing with the fact that sometimes, from time to time, board members' kids have been known to sin. Tragic, I hate to break it to you, but this does happen. And let's say you're not dealing with something that might make the school a little bit more efficient in the financial operation. Let's say you're dealing with Mama Bear and Papa Bear, because Baby Bear finally got what was coming to him. Now, when you're dealing with somebody's kids, it's like you try to walk up and say, here, let me touch your eyeball. you almost always get a spectacular reaction. I mean, just guaranteed. Now, suppose the teachers don't understand this, the administration doesn't understand this, and a board member's kid gets sent to the office and is disciplined. And the board member's kid is the kind of kid, you know, his dad's a bull elk and wealthy and owns the business on the other side of town, and he's never been said no to in his life. So he goes home with some cock and bull story, right? And then dad gets on the horn to the teacher and starts, "I can't believe you did this," you know. Now, this is a danger sign. When Proverbs 18:17 says one person's case seems really reasonable until the other person comes forward and presents their case. People who take decisive, bold action when they've only heard one side of the story are revealing a radical misunderstanding of biblical concepts of justice and processing evidence and so on. Now, if a dad gets a report from his kid that the teacher did this and humiliated me in front of the class and, you know, all this story, you know, this whole story, and he should get on the phone to the teacher, and the grievance policy of the school ought to be, if there's an issue or if there's a problem, you seek to address it where the problem was first. So the parent should talk to the teacher. But the parent, a godly parent, is going to call the teacher up and say something like, "I heard this from my child about this particular incident, and I wanted to get the entire story. Could you tell me what happened from your perspective and hear it all out?" All right. And then, if feelings are running high, say, "Thanks very much for the information. Can I talk to you again tomorrow after I've had a chance to think about it?" Right. And then you process it. You should think. You should try, in situations like this, you should try to think like a crock pot and not like a microwave. Okay? Throw all the stuff in, you know, and I don't mean be angry overnight. I mean to ponder overnight, think overnight, meditate on it, sort it out. Thanks for what you told me. Go check with your kid again, all this sort of thing. So when you check, you're asking questions. You're not asserting. You're not making accusations based on hearing one side of the story already. But if you have a board where the board member thinks that he is the board, "I, in my person, am the board. In fact, I picked all the other board members. I founded the school. I'm the visionary. I'm the bull elk. This is my school. I am the board. I have the right to nail a teacher who disciplines my kid unjustly." Okay? No, you don't have the right to do this, because you are not the board. Now, if you're the sole proprietor, okay. But if you created a board, you want to create a functioning board and a board that's going to grow up to maturity. You don't want to act like you don't want to act in an ungodly way. Now, the teachers need to understand that a parent who approaches them, who happens to be a board member, and it's about a discipline case of their kid, the teacher needs to understand that the school is structured in such a way that they, the teacher, have the authority to treat that board member's kid in exactly the same way that they would treat any other kid in the school. If you have to walk on eggs, if the teachers have to walk on eggs when it comes to discipline of board members' kids, the structure of the school is set up, it's set up wrong. You don't have enough firewalls. You don't have enough protections against individual rogue board members. Now, this is not an academic thing for us. We had two daughters and one son go through Logos School. I've been a board member of Logos School since the beginning. I was the principal visionary that saw the whole thing, and I've been an active board member ever since. And I love that position, and I've done a lot of volunteer teaching in the early years to make it go. But the whole point was to, as I said earlier, to grow up to maturity. Now, as our kids were going through Logos, one of the things we taught our kids was this, and this is just part of the cost of doing business. I believe this is part of the biblical principle: to whom much is given, much is required. It's not to whom much is given, they get to take more. It's to whom much is given, much is required. Our kids knew, going through Logos, that this was our house rule. Kids, when you have a collision with a teacher, as you sometimes will, as you occasionally will. We don't expect you to have a collision because you've been being wildly disobedient, setting fire to the classroom or anything like that. But you will have, there will be occasions where you are graded unfairly. There will be occasions where you get some sort of personality rub. There will be problems, right? And we know that you're going to have problems with teachers during your stint here, during your 13 years here. We want you to know that our operating principle is that the teacher is always right. All right? Now, not all parents have to have that standard. But I believe that influential board members need to have that standard. Does that make sense? Because, and we said, we know that this means that you will sometimes have to eat it. And there will be times where you really, it was not right what happened to you, and we can sympathize with you, and we can commiserate with you, and we will. But I'm not going to use my influence. I'm not going to pitch a fit on the board over your science fair project. I'm not going to do it, and you're just going to have to eat it. Now, they say, well, isn't that unfair? Well, yes, it is unfair. But quite honestly, in the way God made the world, my kids were in a position where they got so many more. You know, it's sort of like a kid who gets a spanking for something he didn't do. And let's say 6 months later it comes out, you know, that I didn't really do that. The parents and the kids ought to have a good enough relationship that they can laugh about it because they say, you know, but to be honest, the kid says, there have been a lot of things that I got away with that I should have been spanked for. And I think, you know, I think the net score is I'm still way ahead. So... And the parents just say, now tell me more about what do you... If you have kids who are in a position of privilege, right, oftentimes kids of influential parents in the school are influential kids in the school. There are all sorts of blessings and perks and that sort of thing that come from that. And there's also a downside. If the parents are being principled and conscientious about this, there's a downside, and you need to cheerfully accept the downside along with the privileges. You can't just greedily take in all the privileges and then try to exert all your influence to keep from paying any of the costs of being in that position. So we knew from the beginning that corporate authority meant corporate authority. That it didn't matter that I was in the position that I was in founding the school. It didn't matter that, you know, that all didn't matter. We had a board meeting, and the board made decisions. And if the board made a decision to pursue something, and the board authorized me to say, and the board, someone on the board made a motion, second, passed, and Doug, would you please check out what we're doing in the seventh grade with this particular textbook? Then I can go to the teacher and the administrator and say, can you give me all the information that has to do with this particular textbook? Because I have to report back to the board, and I've been authorized and charged to do this. In that case, the teacher and administrator and I ought to function as a harmonious committee because all of us are subject to the board's corporate authority. But the individual board member does not carry with him the authority of the board. Now, let me... leave off preaching for a minute, as the cliche goes, and get to meddling. This misunderstanding of pluralism at the top, where you think of board members constituting the board, goes with the affliction that thinks each board member's wife is also the full board. Board members' wives are not the board. All right? Board members' wives are not on the board. Board members' wives individually do not constitute the authority of the full board and ought not to function in any way, shape, or form as though they do. And this is, but this is snarled because if the initiative for sort of making this part of your school culture doesn't come from the board, if this understanding of corporate authority doesn't come from the board, if the board doesn't voluntarily restrain itself, if board member husbands don't teach their families and their wives about the appropriate what's appropriate and what's not appropriate in the school, it is possible but extraordinarily difficult for the administrator or for teachers or individual bookkeepers to mount a defense, all right? Because they know that, you know, this, if the board member's wife walks into the classroom and says, "I'd like to see what you're doing in the third quarter." Now, what's the teacher going to say? It ought to be, "Well, I'm sorry, this is none of your business." Sorry, I wish I could give you... Say, "I'm not sure that would work." All right, okay. How about "none of your damn business"? Now, you see, I think you're being provocative. Well, no. This is a real problem. It's the board member's wife who's being provocative, right? That's the provocation. That's a burnt stick in the eye. You can't just say, "I'm married to someone who got elected to the board a year and a half ago, and therefore the full authority of the board is invested in me, and I'm going to go, and then if I'm going to put the teacher in the position of saying no to me, and then I know that the board member's wife can go back to her husband, and I've had to discipline their kid before, and so I know that they don't know about Proverbs 18:17, right? I know that." And so she's going to go back and say, "All I did was I tried to have a conversation with the fourth grade teacher about, you know..." And he's going to say, "What?" And he's going to bring a motion to the board and, you know, "I'd like the administrator to review this teacher's credentials and that. What's their job evaluation?" You know, this sort of thing can be done in a really ungodly way. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity, when he was talking about Hinduism, talks about the Hindu saying, if you could just see this from the divine perspective, all is one, the cancer and the slum, and all of this is all one. And there's a little footnote where Lewis says, to which the Christian replies, "Don't talk damned nonsense." And then there's a little footnote where Lewis said, these were originally broadcast talks, and he said, one listener complained of frivolous swearing, and he said, "This was not frivolous swearing. I meant damned nonsense." It's not frivolous at all. This is the sort of thing. This is the sort of thing that we need to say. We need to confront sin the way the Bible confronts sin, and we need to stop whitewashing or tidying it up or explaining it some other way. So what happens is the teacher is put in an awful position, the administrator is put in an awful position, and the everybody on staff is put in an awful position, and there is only one thing to do when this situation comes up. The administrator, there's always a ditch on both sides of the road. Sometimes the administrator will represent the interests of the teachers in such a way that, you know, it's sort of like a labor management. I'm always going to argue my staff's interests or what they want, regardless of the facts. I'm not talking about labor management negotiations, but I am talking about when an issue of principle is at stake, like it is here. It is the administrator's task to go to the board and say, "I have to have an assurance that nothing like this will ever happen again." Right? And if I don't have that assurance, then I'm sorry, I'm going to have to find another place to work. And you have my letter, you'll have my letter tomorrow, because I'm not going to function in this way. I'm not going to try to battle this sort of ungodly structure. Now, if at the same time, the administrator has to understand that a lot of times these are not wicked people. These are just people who haven't learned this sort of thing, and they're learning just like you're learning. You're learning how to stand up to people like this, and that kind of person might be a conscientious Christian who's learning how to be stood up to, right? And so, if he's willing to learn, if you're willing to say, "Okay, I'll work with you on this," then work with them. But if there's I insist on having it this way. I think my wife should be able to walk into a classroom and just dictate. Then, please, if you have your wits about you, run for the tall grass now. You don't want to be in that sort of situation. So basically, the administrator has to be able to administer the school, conduct administration of the school, and each board member has to understand that he has no authority apart from an action of the board, and each board member's wife has to understand that she has no authority apart from the action of the board. What this is, the easiest way to describe this is, be aware of the different hats you're wearing. So if one of my kids was in the school and I went for a teacher conference, I had some concern or question, I would want to tell the teacher right up front, look, I'm wearing my parent's hat right now. I'm not, as far as you're concerned, I'm not on the board. I'm just a parent. I want you to know that I know that. Right? And oftentimes when you're first learning how to do it, you've got to be that you have to be that explicit. I'm not on the board right now. I'm not functioning. I'm making a request that any parent might make. And if you say no, no other parent ever asks for internal audit reviews. that's not something parents ask for and say, "Oops, my mistake. Sorry about that." So, at the same time, there are many problems that come from the top. There are many problems of this pluralism at the top. But don't admit slander about the top either. Don't confuse strong personalities with despotism. Right? Sometimes there are some people who can walk into the room and you feel like they're yelling at you, and they're just standing there with their hands in their pockets. But let's be honest, that's your problem. Right? Right? If someone with a strong personality just sort of their vibes make you nervous, you know, come on, grow up, deal with it a little bit. If they are doing and saying things that they ought not to be doing and saying, then yeah, deal with it the way I described before. But if someone is charismatic or they have a strong personality or they're in the building, that's not necessarily sin. That's not necessarily their problem. It's not necessarily a problem at all. And if you have a problem with it, that may be your problem. So don't confuse strong personalities with despotism, and don't confuse individual interest with renegade board members. In other words, a board member might ask an innocent question that any parent might ask, and that's part of their life in the school. And of course, the things they learn, they might bring up at a board meeting, but they might not be a rogue board member. It might just be an ordinary sort of thing. So don't be hypercritical or hypersensitive on this sort of thing, but do develop a strong principial stand on the board. Corporately is the board and nothing else is the board. The administrator is the one who has to be the conduit, the one who communicates with the board, and individual board members have to know what hat they're wearing at what time of the day. Father, we thank you for your goodness to us, and I pray that you watch over us as we continue to contemplate these things. We thank you and we praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.